And now I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Jean M. from Escondido.
Good evening. I'm Jean. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Larry for inviting me to speak. There he is. And I want to welcome the newcomers who introduce themselves and say happy birthday to Kelly. And congratulations to your son for 60 days. That's great. I grew up in western New York, a place called North Tonawanda. North Tonawanda, by the way, made it in Ripley's Believe It or Not for having the most bars in strip, you know, in a certain designated distance. Every other building was a bar. Blue-collar town, a lot of heavy drinking going on there. I grew up in an alcoholic home. I think I knew before I could walk and talk that there was something wrong at home. My mother told me a story that when she was in the hospital giving birth to me, my brother, who's 13 months older, was in his crib, and my drunken dad fell asleep with a cigarette and caught a chair on fire, and my mother's in the hospital with this premonition, I don't think I should have more children. And I said, I don't know if you're psychic or that's just, you know, when you're married to a drunk, you expect unusual stuff to happen, one or the other. But so I grew up in this alcoholic home, and I thought I would be the last person to become an alcoholic. I had a pretty firm conviction until age 16 that I wasn't going to drink. But 16 rolled around, and I thought my thinking changed. You know, I was working in a delicatessen, dairy kind of place with a lot of teenage girls and one old lady, Vera. And Vera and the teenagers would go out drinking after work, and I wasn't invited because I didn't drink. And I thought, well, you know, maybe I could do this and do it differently from my father. And that was my plan. And when I started drinking, I got drunk. Every time I drank, I got drunk. There was no such thing as have one or two drinks. You know, what I know now is that physiologically I'm different from most people. Not most people in this room, but most people out of this room. I'm a lot like you. Out of 10 people who drink, 1 out of 10 is going to become an alcoholic, and I was 1 of the 10. I happen to think that, you know what, it turned out pretty well in the long run, because I have an incredible way of life today that I wouldn't have had I not become an alcoholic. I don't believe. But when I drank, I got drunk, and my motives were excellent. I wanted to be a part of. I wanted to be relaxed. I wanted to be happy. I wanted to celebrate. I wanted to feel a part of. So my motives weren't really that horrible. And you know what? The things that I wanted to accomplish with drink have been accomplished here. I feel a part of today. You know, more a part of certainly than I did when I was in a bar or at a party getting drunk and acting stupid. You know, I found a way to deal with anxiety and depression in a positive way. I found a way to work on building my confidence, and I'll talk more about that later. But when I drank, it was pretty predictable that one of three things were going to happen. Either I'd puke, I'd have a crying jag, or possibly start necking with a stranger. Or maybe all three on any given night. My father died when I was 18. I was a senior in high school. And I have to back up a minute. My substance abuse actually started with prescription medication before I drank. And I say that because the pill that I was prescribed was Valium, and it's a central nervous system depressant. I think it really is alcohol in pill form. Does the same thing. And I was pretty smug. Oh, you know, those drug addicts, I wasn't using drugs. I was getting this medication from the doctor, so I thought I was going to be okay. And he prescribed it for acne, if you can believe that. I think he's the only doctor I've ever heard of in the whole world, and I happened to run into him. And first he gave me phenobarbital, actually, and I would fall asleep for acne. I was about 12, and I would fall asleep at school, and I told him, I don't like this. So he said, I have something else we'll try, and it was Valium. And he said, probably your grades will go from A to B, but you're kind of type A and a little bit too nervous, so... You know, I don't think it cleared up the acne, but I didn't give a shit about the acne. Oops, I'm being taped. Maybe I shouldn't cuss. But, you know, so that's how that went. So when I started drinking, I didn't stop taking the pills. And I often did both at the same time. So I'm really lucky to be standing here. You know, I learned some things later on in recovery that combination could have killed me. Or maybe worse than that, it could have landed me in a coma and my parents would have had to make a decision like, do we pull the plug or not? You know, I remember a story when I was probably in my 20s, a lady named Karen Quinlan who was in that predicament. She was drinking, and I think it was Librium, cousin to Valium. And she ended up in a coma. And there was this big debate, do we turn off the respirator or not? And they did, and she lived in a coma for a while, curled up in the fetal position, weighing 60 pounds. That could have been me, you know, so I'm really lucky that I'm here. Well, my father died when I was a senior in high school, and I'll tell you, I did a pretty good job conning the teachers. I was like this dual person, you know, in school, I was responsible. I joined all the right clubs, Future Teachers of America, the band. I played the clarinet. I was a real geek. I got good grades. I was in the honor society. And when I started drinking, I would tell the teacher I'm going to my clarinet lesson, and then I'd sneak off with one of my friends, and, you know, we'd have alcohol in our thermos, and we would drink. And I just thought that I had joined the in crowd. You know, I was trying to be cool, and I didn't see it as problematic at all. I just thought, I'm just letting my hair down a little bit and having some fun. Despite my drinking, I got 3 scholarships when I graduated from high school to help me go to college. And my mother, when my father died, she said, I don't want you to change a thing. Go away to school as you planned. Get on with your life. And so off I went to this nice little college, Geneseo, in a beautiful part of New York State, rolling hills and lots of snow. And right below my dorm was the Rathskeller, which was the bar. And so I was like crawling distance from the bar. And Wednesday night, you know, over the hump night, and, you know, all those $3 and all the beer you can drink kind of activities. So it was a really easy to be a drunk there, very easy to be a drunk. And, you know, a lot of people begin to experiment at that age, and they're drinking excessively. Maybe not all of them end up alcoholic, but I was already there. And first weekend of school, these are some tales I tell because they remind me that I can never safely take a drink. And, you know, maybe some of you will identify with some of these. This is step one for me, powerless over alcohol, and my life had become unmanageable. They had a keg, $3 and all the beer you can drink. It was off campus in a bar, and they even had a bus, which was a smart thing, so you didn't have to drink and drive. I asked my roommates, who wants to go? Nobody wanted to go. So I go by myself, get very drunk. You know, as I did when I drank, and I was a virgin, but I was like sort of eager to get rid of that status. So I thought maybe I'll meet him the first weekend of school, you know. I hope I'm not being too frank here, but that's how it was. And I picked up this little guy, or he picked me up, I'm not sure which, and came back to my room, but I puked. So it kind of spoiled the atmosphere, and he fled, and my roommates came back, and it started raining, and they thought, oh, it would be so fun to go walk in the rain, but they didn't know what to do with me, so they tied me to a chair. And this was my poor roommate. This was my introduction to her, you know, and I came to college with a case of Boone's Farm apple wine, not pens and pencils, Boone's Farm, and I was ready to party. And, you know, I was really sad about my father's passing, but it was kind of, I was kind of conflicted, because on one hand, I think I thought maybe we can be a normal family now that the drunk is gone. But I became the drunk. You know, so my poor non-drinking mother, you know, now she's got a new family member to worry about. I got good grades despite the drinking. I didn't have the best study habits always. Sometimes I'd procrastinate out of fear or anxiety and try to read a textbook the night before the exam. I did that in political science and got a C. That didn't work out too well. But, you know, my best friend went away to college with me, and she's not an alcoholic, but she drank at that time, and she would say, you've been feeling sad too long. Let's go out tonight so you don't, you know, cry about your dad and feel sad. And so it became, you know, my goal was to relieve some of that sadness. But I was the kind of person who could easily have a cry and jag in a bar, be a whole lot of fun at a party, just get suicidally depressed, weeping. And, you know, I told my fifth step before I knew what a fifth step was to people who didn't want to hear it, you know. I mean, I'd, you know, go to a party, and I'd be the one in the corner talking about how sad my life was and all that woe is me, self-pity. And that I think that was my way of connecting with people, was talking about my problems. But I had no clue about solutions. Well, I transferred to Buffalo, to University of Buffalo, because I hadn't met him yet. I said, maybe he's there, and then life will be grand. And he was there, but he wasn't grand. And I thought he was, you know. He was real cute, but he was really sociopathic and mean, and I was just such a doormat. It was like a perfect match, you know, somebody I could complain about, and he was found somebody he could abuse easily. So I got into that relationship, but one wonderful thing happened. Before I took this class, I went to the counseling center because I knew something was wrong. I was in a lot of despair, a lot of pain, and as you probably know, the first part of our brain to be affected is right here when we drink, the cerebrum. It affects decision-making and judgment. So I made lousy decisions, piss-poor judgment, and including getting involved with this guy. And often doing things that he wanted me to do that really were not in line with my values and morals and the way that I was raised. But I was such a doormat, and I was so eager for this guy's approval. So one of the shameful things I did, I will tell you, part of that unmanageability and part of what eventually motivated me to not want to be like that anymore and to stop drinking, I was bragging about my scholarship money, and he said, I've got a good idea. Give me some of that money, and I'll buy drugs and sell them and multiply your money. I did that. And, you know, I don't feel proud of that. But that's where my decision-making went. That's the kind of person I had become. So I was really ashamed of that. But I went to this counseling center, probably partly the shame from that, and I said, I need to talk to somebody. And this is how it sounded to me. This receptionist said, what is the nature of your problem? And I said, I don't know, but I just need to talk to somebody. You know, I'm really sad. She said, well, nobody's available right now, but give me your name and number. They'll call you later. So later came. By then I was home, probably drinking, probably had a Valium, probably smoked a joint. They called. Problem? No, I don't think I have a problem. I was a little bit down this afternoon, but I'm feeling quite well right now, thank you. And no, I don't need to talk to anybody. And see, I was confused. I thought that those things were the solution. And I did not see that they had become the problem, that my drinking was out of control, my decision-making sucked, and, you know, I was not the person that I wanted to be. But God led me, and I didn't even believe in him then, but God, I believe this was God, who led me to sign up for this class on alcoholism at the University of Buffalo, a class that changed my life. The instructor was an ex-priest, real interesting guy. He was the director of this agency called the Erie County Council on Alcoholism, expert in alcoholism and recovery. He was not an alcoholic, but he knew a lot about the disease and about recovery. And part of the class involved going to AA meetings and Al-Anon meetings and treatment centers. And so I went to an AA meeting thinking, you know, I'm studying the illness that killed my father. This doesn't really relate to me. But I started learning about me. And, you know, one of the things that stands out that they talked about, you know, remember that, if you ever seen that thing called the Jelinek chart? It's like a graph, and it has signs and symptoms of alcoholism. And then on the other side, it's got the upside. This is what happens in recovery, wonderful things that start coming back together. Well, they said, it doesn't matter if you drink every day. You could still be an alcoholic. If you're at the place where when you start, you can't stop, you've got a problem. I remember my mother had challenged my father when he was alive. She said, you couldn't even go 2 weeks without a drink. He said, watch me. Guess what? He went 2 weeks in one day and went, nanny, nanny, poo-poo. I'm not an alcoholic, but that didn't prove anything. That proved nothing. The test is, can you have one and stop? That was the test he couldn't pass, and that was the test I couldn't pass. So I learned that. I also learned that blackouts don't happen to everybody, but they often happen to alcoholics, and I was having them. And they were scaring me. You know, those periods of amnesia where you can't remember what you did. I think sometimes I was happy I didn't remember what I did. But, you know, people usually try to tell us. Excuse me, I gotta wet my whistle here. When I was in elementary school, for some reason, they would always talk on me to call on me to, like, be a leader and a speaker. And I would get so nervous, I would turn red and blotchy, and I would talk 100 miles an hour. And then I would forget to swallow, and I'd choke in the middle of a sentence. So I'm trying not to choke here. I've got to take water breaks once in a while. I still talk fast and turn red, but I don't want to choke on you. So where was I? I distracted myself with that. I took this class on alcoholism, and I was still drinking. And I was bold enough to do volunteer work. with those poor late-stage alcoholics on Skid Row in Buffalo, New York. There was a street called Chippewa Street. It was kind of the red light district, and the instructor of this class had this drop-in center where street people could come. Sometimes they came just to have coffee, just to get a bowl of hot soup, to get out of the cold in Buffalo. But, you know, we'd try to plant seeds and direct them to different agencies where they could detox or get an outfit of clothing or, you know, food voucher or whatever. And I would go there Sunday night, but, you know, Friday night and Saturday night I'm drunk, and sometimes other days during the week, and, of course, I'm still taking my pills. I also took an abnormal psychology class, and I love the way people like me are attracted to classes like that. My major was psychology, and I was so screwed up. But I majored in psychology and sociology, and I was taking abnormal psychology, and I was on my way into the class, and I had one of those things they later told me is called a moment of clarity. I popped a Valium as I went into the class, and I thought, what are you doing? This didn't used to be necessary. What are you doing? And all of a sudden, things that used to be pretty easily done all of a sudden seemed insurmountable unless I drank or took a pill first. So in that class, eventually, I recognized myself, and I quit drinking. I flushed the pills. I'm really lucky that I didn't have a seizure or any kind of really horrific withdrawal. I know that there were sleepless nights and crying jags, and my mother, you know, wanted to know what was going on with me, and I had this great cathartic confession and told her some of my alcoholic sins, and, you know, and she said, I'm just so happy you stopped drinking, you know, and I didn't go to AA yet, and I didn't go for treatment. I just stopped, but I was one screwed up person. I was still in the lousy, sick relationship, and, you know, still full of self-pity. My major favorite thing to do was to blame other people for my unhappiness. I didn't have a clue about how to take responsibility for that. You know, I dwelled a lot on if only he would change, then I'd be happy. If only she would do this, then I'd be happy. If only my mother were more nurturing. You know, if my mother had treated me differently, I'd have more confidence. Nothing but blame, blame, blame. Well, I got a job. I was bold enough to get a job without a program. I did not have a program of recovery, but I got a job at the Niagara County Council on Alcoholism. And the man who'd been my instructor, who inspired me so much, gave me a recommendation, and I got this job. So one of the wonderful things that happened was my knowledge of alcoholism and recovery increased. I had to do a lot of research. I had to do public speaking on the subject, and I would have to I didn't do real intense counseling, but short-term and referral. Somebody would come in, I think I have an alcohol problem. Well, you need AA. I wasn't going. You need Al-Anon, and I'm busy directing traffic, you know, telling everybody what to do with their life, and I still have no program. I worked there about a year, and I stayed sober, and then I transferred to another job that was a treatment center, and I was a counselor trainee. And I would do the intakes and get people's histories and write these beautiful psychosocial histories, and even started teaching, you know, I had to teach about the steps, so I'm reading the 12 and 12, and I'm still not going to meetings. And my one of my dear coworkers became my angel, my rescuer. Her name was Mary Louise, this redheaded bombshell. And she was about, you know, 4'11", and she wore these great big heels and had this big hair piled in her head. But I loved her. And she said, you know what, I'd like you to go to a meeting with me. And she took me to this meeting called the Mod Squad. It was in the 70s. Remember that TV show? It was in Tonawanda, New York. And that's when I, you know, my recovery started happening. And Mary Louise worked with me and on the job and outside of the job in my personal life, you know, starting to guide me. I read something recently, and I wish I remembered who the guy was, but had a bunch of initials after his name, and he said, I'm not a recovering alcoholic, but the program of the 12 steps of AA are the best program of character transformation I know of. And I have to say I agree with that. You know, this program has transformed my character. I'm not the same woman I used to be. I used to have that horrible self-image. It's not there anymore. You know, I've learned to build self-esteem by doing esteemable acts. You know, working with others is one of those things that I discovered early on. I was cleaning our office the other day, and I found this prescription. It's a copy of a prescription that Dr. Bob wrote, one of our founding fathers, and it's a prescription for alcoholism, and he wrote, trust God, clean house, work with others. In a nutshell, that's what we do. And, you know, and so I learned that early on, work with others. Well, I tried the work in others part before I cleaned house by getting these jobs, and I'm going to, you know, going to be this great crusader. But eventually I understood there's other steps in this, and the 12 steps they've transformed me. I didn't have a problem with the first. I have been sober since that, you know, that time. I haven't been one of those who's relapsed, and I'm really grateful. I'm really grateful for that. But I watch, and I open my ears, and I pay attention. And that Jelinek chart that I learned about, I've seen people who've gone down to the very bottom, you know, and I've seen people who started to climb up and then thought, you know what, maybe I could have that drink. And it's never a drink. And then their life goes down, and it goes down faster than before. And the guilt and the shame, I've, you know, worked with, sponsored some women who have such overwhelming guilt when they relapse that they have such a hard time, such a hard time. So I'm grateful that that hasn't been my experience. Many things, positive things have happened as a result of the steps and as a result of applying these principles and steps in my life. My relationship with my mother transformed. I used to always think that my mother, like I was saying earlier, didn't praise me enough and didn't hug me enough and didn't say I love you enough. And, you know, I wanted to blame her for certain parts of my character for that. And my husband, Bill, used to say, why would I be on the phone with my mother, why didn't you say that you loved her when you hung up, before you hung up? And I said, because she won't say it back. And he said, well, so what? You know, don't worry about the kind of mother she is. Worry about the kind of daughter you are. And so I started doing that. Usually I'd kind of give him the finger because I thought, it's none of your business. But then I started following directions, and I'd do it. And you know what? It worked. It worked. That has just improved my relationship with my mother so much. And I've grown into the kind of woman that she can be proud of today. You know, I used to think, oh, she's so judgmental. I deserve to be judged the way I was conducting my life. You know, I deserve to be judged. But today I'm you know, I think I'm a pretty decent person. And so my mother and I have a healthy relationship. She lives in North Carolina now. She lived in Chula Vista for a while. And when she would come to our house and meet AA people, and we have an active house. We open it up and have AA parties, sober parties, and we had a sober wedding. We didn't even serve champagne for those who drank. I said, screw it. They don't have to drink either. We're having a sober celebration. And even the alcoholics were struck by the love in the room. They couldn't believe it. Some of my cousins who are full-blown alcoholics, wow, you've got wonderful friends, and there's this atmosphere in this room that's just we've never felt before. And one of Bill's siblings was chipping out to the car, I think, to get his. But, you know, we had a great time. We had a wonderful time. But anyway, my mother noticed all these loving people in our lives, and she would just say, wow, you've got an incredible life. And this year she sent me a birthday card that really touched me. She said, you have had some unusual twists and turns in your life and some kind of different weird things that have happened, but you've come out of it a better person as a result, and I'm so proud of who you are today. And that was wonderful. I'm going to go see my mom in June. My mother's got a lung disease that's, you know, probably going to kill her. She's not getting enough oxygen. She's on oxygen 100% of the time, and she's just declining and getting weak. So, you know, I get to go there. I get to go there and say it one more time. I went in November and thanked her for being the kind of mother that she was. You know, I said, thank you for all you did, the sacrifices you made, and I apologize again for any worry and, you know, that I caused you. But I know today she doesn't worry about me, and that's comforting. It's really comforting. And, you know, things don't have to go unsaid. Well, I made some lousy decisions in sobriety. I have to tell the truth. One of them was my first marriage. And, you know, if you have a really strong gut feeling, I know that it's happened to me a couple times when I've had this really strong gut feeling that I ignored. I think God was trying to tell me something, and I did not want to hear it. I don't know if any of you can relate to that, if you've ever done that, but when he said, will you marry me, I was like, you know, I really wanted to be married. And I think that's what it was. I wanted to be married. I didn't really want him. But I convinced myself in my head, looking at the positives in him, oh, he's funny and he's cute and he's interesting and, oh, it's going to be so wonderful. He was from another country, and I thought that was sort of exotic. And it turned out to be not exactly exotic. It turned out to be kind of a big problem and something that eventually divided us. He was from Libya, North Africa, and of a different faith. But although he wasn't practicing his faith when we got married, after we got married, after I got pregnant, he dove into it full bore and wanted me to follow the same path. And I said, you know, I'm happy for you, but I don't have the same, you know, in my gut, I don't have that same conviction that you do. But anyway, it caused a lot of problems, and all these rules started coming out. You know, you can't wear makeup. That blouse is too see-through. Those shorts are too short, and all these rules and regulations. I'm an American woman. I'm not used to, you know, the kind of rules and regulations that women follow in his country. And so we ended up separating. I was really terrified to go for a divorce, but, you know, eventually I worked up the courage and filed for divorce, and his response was to kidnap my son when he was 3 years old, and he took him to Libya. And I got a phone call in the middle of the night from his roommate telling me that's where they were. Did I want the phone number? I was like, this has to be like a practical joke. I can't even believe it. So I call, and we do a lot of cussing and hanging up on each other. The first few phone calls, a lot of hatred, a lot of rage. And, you know, people in the program said, you know what, we have a formula for that. Read that chapter one more time, Freedom from Bondage. And in there it talks about when you have a resentment, you pray for the person that you resent for 14 days, pray for them to have the good things in your life, for them to have the good things in their life that you want in yours. So I had to start praying for him. And to tell you the truth, I wanted to take up a collection to send an assassin is what I really wanted to do. I mean, I was mad. I was hurt. I was mad. But I'm praying and trying to get over this bitterness. And eventually we were able to have some civil conversations. And he said, you know, I'd like to try it again as a family. If you want your son, you get me too. And I'll make arrangements for you to come to my country if you want to do that. So I got different advice. You know, conflicting advice from people. Some said, no, don't go. The only person you're indispensable to is yourself. Your son will survive without you. I went to a psychiatrist who happened to be Arabic and Muslim, and I asked him, am I crazy to think about going there? I knew him from a hospital that I'd worked at in San Diego or in La Mesa, and he said, I think if you don't go, you'll regret it forever. And he knew, he'd met my ex, and he said, I don't think the marriage will work. He's a very immature man. He's not crazy, but he's very immature. He cannot meet your needs. But there's only so many years for parenting, and I strongly advise you to go. So I went. I quit my job, kissed my boyfriend goodbye, and, you know, I went. And when I saw my son in the airport, his dad had somebody who worked there sneaking behind the scenes. So there he was, wearing a little Arabic outfit with this big bouquet of wilted roses. And, you know, and I just, when I saw my son, I thought, there's no way I'm leaving. And I thought maybe there's a trick I can pull, you know, to get out of here with him. Actually, I had talked to this professional kidnapper who told me, we'll get fake passports, we'll string dynamite around the trees in front of the house he's staying at. When he comes out, we'll grab him, we'll run down the street, we'll jump in a boat, and we'll go to Tunisia. Honest to God, this is a story this guy told me. I was working at API at the time, and I started crying on the job. I said, you have to be crazy. And he wanted $40,000, which I didn't have, so we didn't go with that plan. We went with plan B, and I went over there, you know, not knowing what I was going to do. I took the big book. I took the 12 and 12. I wrote letters constantly to people, pouring my heart out. And I was civil. I didn't put any arsenic in his food ever, I swear. And we were civil, and we stayed there 3 years. And when I got there, he said, let's just, the past is in the past. Let's forget it, and we're not going to talk about that, and I'm sorry. I made a mistake, but you're here now, and let's be a happy family. And he immediately wanted to have another child, and I thought, not a good idea, because this is really not happy. I'm being polite, but I'm not happy. But eventually, I thought, you know, I'm not going to get out of here if I don't. I have to show commitment to this relationship. So we had another child, and after 3 years in Libya, after I was there 3 years, my son was there 4 months without me before I got there. But after 3 years there, we came back to El Cajon. And I got, you know, back in my life. And I had these gaps in terms of my relationship with AA. I never drank. Thank God I never drank. But I got crazy. And this was one of those crazy periods. Because I've been 3 years without a meeting. I came back. I stayed with him seven more, really out of fear. And my plan was, I'll wait until the kids are 18. The youngest one's 18. I'm out of here. And one day he said, you know, you are a terrific woman. You're a terrific mother. And what I did in our, you know, marriage was so wrong. I'd never do it again. But I think we should divorce. I think we both deserve to be in relationships where we're happy. He said, I'm under no illusion. You don't want to be with me. You're here for the kids. So we had a really peaceful divorce. I mean, it was incredible. After what happened the first time, we didn't even hire a lawyer. And AA is responsible for that, you know, that Freedom from Bondage chapter, praying for him. And so I got a do-it-yourself divorce book. I did the paperwork, and we had a, you know, split custody. We didn't own anything, so there wasn't really property to split. But, you know, we had to keep communicating about our children, and we chose to live just 3 miles apart so they could get to school from either house and all those cozy things. But, you know, that's the beauty of AA. You can get through things that in life you can never imagine that you'd be able to get through. I worked in three different jobs that couldn't have happened if I was a drunk. One was an alcoholism counselor. The second one was a teacher. I did that for a few years, went back to college as an adult, got a teaching credential. And then the third one, which really blows my mind, because I used to like dating thugs, I became a probation officer. And, you know, my mindset's different, you know. And I thought, I'm not sure if I can do this job, but I thought, I'm going to give it a try. And it was so perfect for me. I worked with teenagers. I never worked with adults, strictly with teenagers. And I think they felt like my background with alcoholism counseling, with personal recovery, because I told the full truth and nothing but the truth, so help me God. When you apply to be a probation officer, you have to fill out reams of paper. What drugs have you used? How many times? When was the last time? You know, have you ever been in counseling? Have you ever been abused? And then you have this 2.5-hour background interview. You take 2 psychological tests. You meet with a shrink. It's unbelievable. And I thought, damn it, after all that, jumping through those hoops, if they offer the job, I'm going to say, yes, please, I'll take it. So I did. And they put me in with teenagers. And I had 2 different assignments and the first 3 years. And then juvenile drug court started. There was already an adult drug court, but juvenile drug court started, and I volunteered to go there. Believe me, there was not a big line of probation officers wanting to go to juvenile drug court. Probation officers hate working with alcoholics and addicts unless they're in recovery themselves. They don't understand relapse. They get fed up real fast. But I thought, this is my perfect niche. I've worked as a teacher. I've worked as a counselor. I'm in recovery. I grew up in an alcoholic home, as many of those kids, you know, many of them were in alcoholic homes. So it was a perfect fit. And I did that 7 years, I mean, as in drug court, 10 total. And it was wonderful. I got to work with teenagers who were just like I was. And they used to say, you are different. You're really something different about you. You're different from some of our other probation officers. And I'd never been on probation, so I wasn't really sure what I was supposed to be like. But there's 2 types of probation officers. I think there's cop types who are into arresting, catching you doing wrong. And there's social worker types who are into rehab and really trying to help people change their lives. And some are a mixture of both. But I was definitely more on the social work mindset, you know, and it was an incredible job, never dull, totally interesting, and I got to see the kids in drug court. They had to have 9 months of consecutive sobriety to get off probation, and it was wonderful. Some of them did well. Some of them didn't. A couple died, you know, and that's the nature of our beast. Even as teenagers, a couple of them died from alcoholism or drug-related. One got stabbed in the throat and a drug deal gone bad. Another one, a DUI, you know, overdoses, gang fights. But many of them did well, and that was wonderful. I felt like we were seed planters. Some of those youth may make it back here. Some of them may be drinking today, but they may make it back here because they had a taste of AA or NA and 12 steps, and so they know where to come if they, you know, finally hit bottom. Let's see. The other wonderful thing, another really wonderful thing that happened is my current marriage. I've been married for, 8 years. In May will be 8 years. And we dated for a few, but we've been friends since I moved here in 1978. Met my husband, Bill. We both worked in the treatment, and he worked at Pathfinders. I worked at the county detox. And so we were acquaintances, but I was married, having kids. He was in a long-term relationship, and then I was single again, and I was at an AA convention, and I thought, well, you know, I'm sober enough that I could, like, look around here. I'm not a newcomer. You know, maybe there'll be somebody cute here I'll be interested in. And there was Bill standing at the top of the escalator. And he, so glad you made it back safely. And, you know, and asked for my phone number. And then he didn't call. But eventually he did. And we ran into each other again. And he collected the number again. And then we started dating. And he said, but I was in this committed relationship for a really long time. And I'm not looking for commitment. I want to be honest with you. And I'm not looking for marriage ever. I said, okay, take note of that. So I knew that he was seeing other women, and I thought, okay, he's honest, and I won't, you know, just won't let myself get too head over heels for him. But I started, you know, falling in love with him, and it was hurting my feelings that he was seeing others. So I just got more direct than I've ever been, and I just said, you know what, don't call me, don't page me. Those were the days of pagers. And, you know, if you're at a meeting, I'll wave at you, but that's it. We're through. I cannot be, you know, one of your harem. I want to be the one, and somebody else will find me enough. So, and, you know, I don't know how many days later or weeks later, but he called me and he said, you know, you're everything I'm looking for. I don't know what I'm afraid of. You're everything I'm looking for. And so whoever the others were, he cut them loose. And then we got married. You know, that thing that he said he was never going to do, he did. But he was under the influence of narcotics because he'd had an operation and it was in the recovery room. And I kind of made him say uncle. His sister was there to witness. So, you know, we got engaged and we got married. But Bill is so in love with AA, and it makes me so in love with him. My goodness, he's such a wonderful example. He sponsors many men. He's done so many outstanding things in recovery, including starting an Alano club and working in the field, but mainly carrying the message, you know, through the 12 steps. And as a sponsor, and during our courtship, he ran into some medical complications, and he had a toe that had gangrene related to diabetes, and he went in to have the toe amputated, and they were going to do some other things that were going to improve his walking and make him have less pain when he walked. But he was at the Navy hospital, and they had a young resident who was kind of practicing, and he gave him an epidural, which was what they planned as an anesthesia, but it caused a spinal cord injury. So instead of walking better, he lost the ability to walk. And I never saw him cry. I mean, it was the most amazing, amazing thing that I saw. See, I'm crying. He didn't cry, though. You know, I saw the evidence of these steps working, you know, one more time. And a couple years later, bumped the other foot, got gangrene, ended up losing his leg. And so, it you know, they were scary times. But he said, you know what, I'm alive. My family's back in my life. I have so many friends who love me. I have a life with purpose. And he says, you know, the first part of recovery, you're learning to live sober. Now he says, I'm learning to die with dignity and sobriety, no matter what, you know. And he's my hero. 4 days after his leg was amputated, he was on stage at the Roots meeting speaking. They had asked him, because he had 30 years sobriety, and, you know, the Roots meeting, they have a panel of people, and four or five, and each of them has at least 30 years, and that was the first year that he was eligible, and they asked him to speak, and he told the doctor, you have to postpone the operation or guarantee I'll be able to go. And he said, okay, well, we can't postpone it, because this infection can spread into your system and kill you. We gotta go for this. And on that fourth day, he was on that stage. Thanking AA. You know, thanking his God and thanking AA. And these are the kind of incredible things that we've been able to get through together. I sponsor some women. Some are doing well. Some are not doing well. The bottom line is I'm doing well. I keep carrying the message. I keep trying. Some of them are going to get it. Some aren't. Actually, since we moved to Escondido, well, August will be 5 years ago, because we found a perfect wheelchair accessible home. And God is so good. You know, the hardship of the spinal cord injury and all the doctor's mistake, but we ended up with a bundle of money that helped us buy a spectacular home that's fully wheelchair accessible, ramps from every exit, beautiful garden all the way around, and we're half a block from a daily AA meeting. We didn't know that meeting was there until we got there. I mean, how good is God? You know, I mean, it's just a perfect deal. So where was I going? Oh, women in Escondido. So you know, somebody new in town, so a number of women start, you know, asking me to sponsor them, and three of them died. And one was a gorgeous woman, brilliant, beautiful, in a sober living, trying meetings on and off, but just couldn't get it, you know, a lot of depression, and found in her room at the sober living surrounded by empty booze bottles and pills bottles, dead. Another one, beautiful woman, beautiful husband, beautiful kids, many treatment attempts. I met her while she was in a sober living. We got through steps 1 through 3. I gave her the stuff to start on 4. I'm too busy. I really can't do this now because I've got to get a job. I said, you've been unemployed, stay-at-home housewife for many years. You do not have to get a job. Your husband's a rich contractor. You know, just first things first. Or at least spend a certain half an hour a day working on step 4. Nope, gave me all the stuff back. Multiple treatment episodes, relapses. She moved to her family in Temecula, and I'd go up once a week to a meeting. And then I said, I think you need a sponsor closer to you. So she got one, but she kept relapsing. And they found her dead, drowned in her backyard swimming pool under the influence of Ativan and alcohol. Beautiful 42-year-old woman with two teenage girls. You know, one was starting college, the other one was still in high school. So, oh, man, and the other one decided to try heroin one more time, and she'd done it before and thought, I'm sure she thought, I'll come back. I'm just going to do this, and I'll get back there and pull it together again. So I feel really grateful. I saw my father die from alcoholism. I've seen these women and many others in the 36 years that I've been sober, many, many others. So I'm really, really grateful that I've stayed on this path. I'm really grateful that I believe. You know, in our big book, in page 24, it talks about why people relapse, and it says some people are unable to recall with sufficient force, I don't remember the exact words, but basically how crappy it was. They cannot recall what happened a week ago or a day ago or a month ago. And I'm glad I can, and I'm glad I keep listening to your experience so that, you know, that doesn't have to be mine. I used to spend a lot of money on therapy. I got it for free tonight. I hope you got some benefit. I certainly did, telling you my story. Thanks for listening.